Hey, Glenn from Made by Folk here. In this episode, I'm talking to Richard Baird, who founded BP&O, the Logo Archive, and the Brand Archive, three very successful side projects that have turned into actual businesses. And for this episode, I'd like to try a slightly different intro where, rather than telling you too much about what we're talking about, I want to tell you more about what I learned through this conversation. So hopefully it'll encourage you to listen to the whole interview and it will show you already what you can learn at an early stage. So the main takeaways for me from this conversation were just Richard's endless amount of enthusiasm, passion for his projects. You know, his passion really fuels his creativity. It will come as no surprise that his persistence and consistency and building a dedicated community for these projects has led to them being successful long-term projects. And that might seem obvious, but it's always great to have that confirmed by someone who's already put that to good use. He also noted how much collaboration has elevated his work over the years and reiterated how much balancing multiple ventures or projects requires discipline. He walks us through an example of his day-to-day routine and he reiterated how much balancing multiple ventures requires discipline. So I hope you find this episode as useful as I found it and that you'll enjoy the interview. Welcome to Made by Folk, Richard. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to chatting with you.
I said this when we had our little intro call. Like, I feel like I've known you for so long. Although we've never met, I kind of already feel like I know you as this weird internet acquaintance.
Yeah. Likewise. I've followed Made by Folk for quite some time as well.
So I think, like, you know, to give a little introduction to anybody that hasn't heard of you, hasn't come across all the projects that you've started, you know, over the last sort of 15 years or so, you've launched a website called BP&O, Branding, Packaging and Opinion, where you give opinions on brand design and packaging design that is current and coming out. But then you have these more historical archives. One is the Logo Archive, which I think you also did sort of different publishing projects under that name, one of which I have here, one of the first editions from back in the day. And the new Brand Archive, where you lovingly photograph and document these brand guidelines that in some cases I have never actually seen in print. I've always just seen sort of like photographs of like the outside maybe, and you go through them and document them in such a detailed way. So throughout all these side projects that you started, I've always been really interested to hear kind of like the backstory of what led you to start these initially and then how they so evolved to take over your day-to-day work. So today I'd love to just kind of dive in a little bit into, you know, like a little retrospective of these projects, what led you to create them in the first place, and also kind of what you learned along the way and what I can maybe learn from you. I think that would be super useful for me at least.
Yeah, so I think the recurring theme is that I actually don't overthink things. I'm quite impulsive, and that actually there's sort of two sides of that. One is you can make mistakes, but on the other side you can get things going and not sort of stop yourself from doing things. So with BP&O, and the other thing actually is accountability, is telling somebody that you're going to do it the moment that you think of doing it. The first time was a friend of mine. I said, look, I'm going to start a blog today. I'm going to get it online and I'm going to start publishing articles tomorrow. I didn't overthink it. There was the accountability of saying it to someone.
What was the desire that led you to that statement to your friend? Like what was missing for you in the, I mean, I guess this must've been close to the time when we launched Form 55, sort of 2009, 2010 or?
Yeah, I remember it was really around sort of brand new. Is there were a lot of people, there was some really good discourse that was happening on brand new. It wasn't toxic in any way, and people were making quite a lot of effort
at that point.
And I think it was just sort of, it came from Speak Up, right? Where Speak Up had a really engaged audience. And I was commenting on that and I was participating in that. And I, for some reason, I just thought, I don't know why I'm putting so much effort into somebody else's platform. Mm. And like, of course, it's the community, but there's this content generation that happens within the comment section. And when you're putting a lot of effort in, I think sometimes you want to have your own space to cultivate your own audience. I started to sort of develop an opinion, and I think back to it and I thought, you knew nothing and there you were like hammering away, right? But I knew that, and this is the same for most of the other projects, is I knew I would improve over time and I shouldn't be afraid of being wrong at the beginning.
But that's a great attitude to have that I'm still struggling with. You know, like I always try, my biggest barrier is like, I want to make it absolutely perfect and polished and great. You know, what's often hindered me just continuing this podcast is like, oh, I didn't have the right microphone or the right light or the right structure. And then I just wouldn't do it. So now I'm just trying to take a more relaxed approach and just do it. And I will learn. I'll still make mistakes. I'll still send people the wrong link to the interview or forget to hit record. Yeah. You know, I will get better at it over time.
It's also worth appreciating that the way that people perceive you from the other side will vary quite differently from person to person. So some people will criticize you for what you're doing. And then some other people will see it as valuable and interesting. And those are the people that you really want to have as your audience or to have a conversation with. And then hopefully you can get those other people on board at a later date.
So BP&O, you launched while you were still a freelance designer, is that correct?
So I've always been freelance from 2005, just when I left university. My father was freelance, so he'd already seeded that possibility in my mind. And so I just, that's how I actually got started in design, as a furniture designer and then graphic design.
Awesome. And then the project sort of, BP&O specifically, sort of then like just grew and grew. And did it already open like some doors for you initially then as a freelancer, or what kept you motivated to continue on? Was it purely just the positive feedback you were getting from the audience?
The reason I kept BP&O going was two things. One is that I think it's slightly pathological, is I find it difficult to let go of things. So I just, once I set up a routine, I just keep going and going. So that's sort of one aspect of it. The other aspect is, yes, there is the benefit of getting some kind of work from it. For sure, people will come in and say they thought that I was the person doing the work, even though the titles were clearly said by Pentagram. And I would say, look, I didn't design this, but I can try to do something like that for you. You know, and I'd always like send them to the Pentagram website or whatever design studio. But it wasn't actually a huge amount of work that came in from that. And I think realistically, looking back at that period, is I was living in the Czech Republic. My rent was really, really low. And so there wasn't necessarily the fear or the pressure to keep getting new clients. And that's where I could balance 50% of my time on BP&O, so the morning, and then the afternoon would be spent doing some client work. As I said, there is no real sort of pressure or fear here. And I think that really helps sort of early on when you're trying to start your first kind of side project.
Definitely. That is definitely a luxury to have. So how did these projects then evolve, and how did the logo archive and now the brand archive evolve from that initial project?
Yeah, Logo Archive started as an Instagram project. I'd actually been collecting a lot of these books and scanning them in and filing them away. And I'd created a filing system so that I could quickly look through all of these. And I thought, well, why don't I just put them onto Instagram? I was posting three a day for, you know, 2 years. And it seemed like it was getting a lot of traction because no one had put this stuff online before. And I was just excited by the work, and I could see other people are excited. And for a lot of young designers, they were thinking that this was all sort of modern recent stuff. And you're like, no, this is like 50, 70 years old. There's some that were 100 years old. So you get that kind of thrill. And of course, there's the Instagram algorithm. Back then, they were super generous. I was getting you know, thousands of new followers. And so, yeah, it pumps you up and you're excited for it. And then there's a point where I think when I moved to London, this is where there was a bit more pressure in terms of sort of expenses that I had to live with. So I was thinking about ways of monetizing that in a way that I felt would honor that work. People would say, you should do a book. And I really felt I shouldn't do a book, that it seemed like the obvious thing to do. And I'd gone to like an exhibition on pamphleteering. And I saw these pamphlets from the 1960s and 70s. They were political pamphlets. And I thought, you know what? If I did a really light booklet, I could ship these low cost all over the world. And so instead of someone buying a 40, 60, 100 pound book, someone in India could afford to have this sort of document sent to them low cost, and everybody could have it and collect it. And I thought that was the big breakthrough for me. It felt old but new again. And I think that's what I try to do with all of these new projects, is I take the old thing and I try to make it feel new again, and try to engage young designers through channels that are interesting or what they're familiar with. And that sort of intersection is where I'm quite excited.
How these projects evolved over time, I think you must have learned like a lot about not only how to promote these individual projects, but basically sort of mistakes that you made on previous attempts and how you want to improve and what things you want to do different for the next one. So Brand Archive, your most recent one, I would imagine you must have already had like a foundation of, okay, I want to avoid these situations. I definitely want to do more of a certain aspect. Mm. Like, can you share any sort of insights into the sort of like clear direction that you had for the Brand Archive, or any pitfalls that you wanted to avoid that you know that you had learned from in the past?
Yeah, so luckily each thing builds on, well, I mean, everything builds on the thing that goes before, but when I look back, it actually seems very clear. It's like I didn't monetize BP&O. I just wouldn't put adverts on, even when it was getting hundreds of thousands of people per month. Like, we didn't quite get to 1 million page views per month, but it was getting around there. And if I just put an advert on there in the early days, that I think I would have had more opportunities to experiment with other side projects sooner. It took me nearly a decade to sort of figure out how to turn these projects into sustainable businesses. And I think that's the most important thing that I want to really sort of emphasize, is if you want to build something that is substantial, it needs to exist for a long period of time to accumulate articles or whatever you're platforming to build an audience. And it actually, there's with BP&O, there were expenses like content delivery networks to make sure that the site was running really, really fast in different places all over the world that people were starting to expect. There were lots of different costs that were creeping in that I was paying for out of my own pocket. And there was a point to which it was like, oh, this might not be sustainable. So with Logo Archive, first it was the zines, and that worked out really, really well. But for anyone that's done publishing or sold anything, is that first issue sold out in like a day. The second issue sold out in 3 days. The third issue sold out in a week. And, you know, eventually it doesn't sell out, right? It's that people lose the enthusiasm and the interest because it's not new. And of course, you're competing with an incredibly rich and growing sort of e-commerce environment within the design industry. There are people throwing all sorts of ads at you, newsletters at you, all these kind of things. So I knew that the next project, that Logo Archive, needed to take on more of a software slash tool kind of model where I could get enough money in that could guarantee that I could publish new logos to the site every day for the next 10 years, right? Because that's how long I expect to be doing this for. You know, I would like, I think we're nearly actually the biggest online archive of historical logos.
I would say so.
But I want that to continue to grow. And so there's the commerce kind of component to it. And I try to balance things out. I publish things for free on Instagram, but if you want access to the whole archive, there's a paywall. There's a like a personal growth that needs to happen.
To upsell it here a little bit, the great tool that you've built with Logo Archive is actually being able to use all the data that you've attached to those scans, to those images, so you can find them much quicker. On Instagram, you have to just kind of scroll through and see what comes up. But when you actually use the tool, like the website, you have so much more control to be able to find what you're looking for a mood board or for some inspiration or to show some a client some examples.
You're right. And that's the, for me, that was the personal development that had to happen, is that I was really worried about locking these things down. I've seen people say, you know, design resources should be free for everybody. And I understand that point of view. And it certainly comes from a place of generosity and goodwill. But my belief is that if you want to build something big, you have to figure out the economics of it. And that means that if you're going to platform it and build a tool, it has to be really, really useful.
Yes. I think because you counterbalance that with BP&O and the amount of time that you've contributed to the design industry and the design scene for free, I think that gives you a little bit more credibility when you then start building a tool that's a paid service. You know, then I think like people will be a little bit more forgiving with you making that decision.
Yeah, I think that helped. That certainly helped when I launched it. I was really, really scared of launching a paywall product, but I could see that everybody was really behind it, and people that had followed me from BP&O. But you do, of course, get people that know nothing about the other projects that I've done and the time that I've spent doing them, and they don't understand the time that it takes to do these things. And they raise questions about it. Why is it paywalled? And I think that's fair.
Yeah, I think it is, definitely. Let's take a quick break because I'd like to tell you more about Current, the place to see all of your team's work. We've all been there. It's Monday morning and you're back at work after a weekend that felt just a little bit too short. You know, last week the team made a ton of progress, but you can't remember which files to look at, which tools to open, which Slack channel that link was shared to. Now imagine your team was using Current. Current integrates with all the tools that your team is already using to let you see all the work in one place and give you and your team better alignment. And at the end of each week, Current's AI-powered newsletter automatically summarizes all the work posted and shares it with everyone so that your Monday can start a little less chaotic. Go and visit current.so and transform how you work. Well, talk me through a little bit more of the practical side of your day-to-day today. You know, I've always been, you know, super envious of anybody who I've admired for so many years, sort of make their initial little hobby and side project into their main focus, a step that I've never managed to do or I've never had the courage to do. So I'd love to kind of just hear how you now make that work. What's that life? The life you're living, kind of live like my dream through you of hearing, like, what does it like to kind of run your main side projects as a main business? And how do you split your time across these projects? Like, run me through a day in the BP&O logo archive and brand archive world, because you also do so many other projects. I didn't even touch on them. Occasionally a podcast, educational tools, you know, there's an endless list.
Yeah, we did a domestica course recently, which was really interesting. I joined the course. Well.
Yeah, of course.
Joined the course group.
You did these talks on YouTube for the logo archive as well, where you kind of did this deep dive into the project and individual. I mean, hats off. I don't know where you find the time.
I think when you talk about this kind of thing, and I will tell you like how, what my day looks like, I think it's important that young designers understand that this isn't like a template, right?
It's at everyone that time, has to find that you were in the right place at the right time to make those initial steps happen. You can't then take that same formula, place it in 2023 and expect the same results.
Yeah, I do worry when people make courses about this and people think that, you know, this is what should be done. I get up at like 6:15. I'm ready and out the door within 20 minutes. And it's just capturing that energy and enthusiasm for the day and get out to the co-working space that I'm in. It's purely because there is like this enthusiasm and excitement for building these kind of things. And that's why I wake up. And I've always been someone that as soon as I wake up, I get up. I don't stay in bed. And I think that's sort of one part of it. There's that saying, it's like getting out of bed is the first win of the day, right? These things that you tell yourself really help. I get into the co-working space. I drink a lot of coffee really early on. And I find that there's a window of like 3 hours between 7 and 10 where I get a lot of stuff done. And the way I do it is I simply write a list. I have a really nice moleskin lined booklet that looks like a, you know, one of those like things that police would flip open and sort of ask you questions.
Oh, right.
And like,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. People, when I brought that into the co-working space, there were lots of jokes about that. I just couldn't find a way to make Notion or Trello or any of these things work. I tried, but I find writing the job down, crossing it out really works. Depending on the day, it could be doing the technical side of BPNO. So I'll receive an article from my editor, Eleanor Robertson, who will have edited work that will have come in from another writer. And that will take me an hour to do, upload project images and tag them and do all of the tiny things I've been doing for such a long time to make it visible to Google. I'll upload logos to Logo Archive. It's actually very repetitive for that 3 hours. It's like the same thing every day. But because it's always sharing something new.
Are you sourcing the new books along the way for Logo Archive? Or do you still have such a long backlog of content that you still are getting through?
Yeah. Okay. So this is quite hard to describe. I have like a system, right? So I'll import a book from Japan. I'll scan the pages. I'll digitize them if they're logos, and then I'll upload them to Logo Archive. I'll then take the information and then I'll archive the information about the projects, and I'll then repurpose that for Logo Histories, which is a paid newsletter. I'll then put the book onto the Logo Archive shop to then sell the book once I've used the book. So there's like a pipeline, if you will, where I'm making every part of that book, every piece of value or piece of insight is archived and ready for me to use in a different project. And so I've got new deliveries coming in, not every week, but you know, every month. And there are some real things that keep me really excited is when I find some Japanese brand guidelines. When I find those, I just can't wait to scan them in and share them with people. And that now goes into brand archive. So every part of that book becomes something else for somebody else to learn from and find joy in.
Amazing. Yeah, that's so good. I mean, and do you then find these on like various, like eBay and just sort of various websites? Or how do you find the Japanese ones in particular?
The Japanese ones are quite hard. So what I did was I didn't teach myself Japanese. I just basically Googled what is graphic design in Japanese, and I copied and pasted the kanji into Google search. I then went to the image pages and I looked for all the product tags, and I would then click through and see where all the stores are. And so I bookmark all of the stores. I bookmark all of the terms, so graphic design, brand identity design, logo design, and I simply copy and paste them into the search fields. And then I use a consolidation tool to have the orders sent to them, and then they pack them all up and then send like a large box.
Brilliant. To me. Man, you've got it all figured out. Genius. Like, it's so good.
It took a while. It took a while.
I bet.
And it's all also right, so like then, a risk, because you don't know what you're necessarily getting. You don't know what the condition is, because you can't, I mean, you do Google translate the pages, but mostly I don't know what's inside the book. I have to kind of guess that there's going to be images.
Yeah. I mean, I can edit this out later if you don't want to answer, but can I ask what's like the most expensive brand guidelines you've purchased so far on one of these obscure Japanese websites?
I think I did an £800 one. Yeah. You start to build like a war chest for this kind of thing. And, you know, the more you sell, the more you can take a bit more of a risk on these kind of more high price items.
Nice one. So I had sort of planned to ask you the pros and cons of running these side projects. You know, you've done this for a long time. You kind of then decided to focus more on what initially was a side project to really make it your day-to-day work. Like for others thinking about this idea, what are the positives and negatives of going down that path? Like what are you definitely seem to have a lot of enjoyment out of your work and enthusiasm for doing more, even if you find it potentially repetitive, although I think you still find enjoyment in that. But what are potentially the downsides of focusing on your side projects? Because overall, it always seems, you know, mostly positive.
Yeah, I think the hidden downside is the monotony of it. It's one thing to build something, which is a hurdle in and of itself. But really, the majority of your time is dedicated to developing an audience or channels of communication with people that, or even finding people that are interested in the things that you have to share or the work that you're producing. And so most of my time is actually spent like creating content or like social media content to drive people towards these things. So I think you really need a very disciplined mindset that says, I'm going to give this a really good shot over a long period of time. I think just making sure that there's not too much risk involved, especially if you have a full-time job. And just being clear with yourself about whether is this a short-term project or a long-term business. Early on, I should have done that at the beginning of each of these projects. I only did that with Brand Archive. Because once you know what that sort of goal is, then you can decide how much time you want to spend with it. If it's financial freedom, then figuring out what is the economics of running something like that when you end up with thousands and thousands of people per day on the site, how much does that cost you? And whether you actually have the time to do this kind of thing. For short-term projects like, you know, type 365 or whatever, where they're posting work every day, I think these things are really, really great ways of building up like portfolios and stuff, but it's a different conversation compared to building a BP&O or a logo archive or a brand archive over a decade.
So you were basically just talking us through your day-to-day. I think we got into lunch where you were saying you basically are sort of like adding a few logos potentially to logo archive, and then you're gonna chat us through the rest of your day.
Yeah, so the rest would be creating social media content to promote the various products that I have, scheduling them. I use a tool called Meet Edgar. I think I have like 300 instances that go out per week. I keep topping them up, so creating content libraries and creating new categories as well. I'm trying to figure out new things that people might find interesting, new ways of configuring what I already have. And then I might jump onto some newsletters, writing the Logo Archive newsletter, Brand Archive newsletter, and keep people engaged. And that was another thing that I learned with Brand Archive was customer journeys. So creating a series of emails over a month to keep engaging with people and, of course, trying to convert them to paid members. And then I'll move on to some client work, so a couple of hours of working on client projects. I've only got one client left on retainer, but that creates a bit of a safety net for me each month. I go for a walk. It's just something I've been doing more recently because I spend so long sitting down. I know you're supposed to stand up and drink water and all that kind of stuff, but I get so focused on what I'm doing. So yeah, now I'll go for a walk. I'm now in a co-working space, which is quite new for me. I did most of my 15 years working from my bedroom or working from home. So some of my time is spent just talking with people, just listening to how their days are going, developing friendships, that kind of stuff. So I'm kind of developing my interpersonal skills a little bit there. And then it kind of starts to go downhill for me in terms of like energy for work at about 3. So I'll switch to jobs that are mechanical and don't require much thinking. So SEO, digitizing logos, anything along those lines. So anything that requires a lot of thinking, I do between 7 and 10. And then just do the sort of day to day. And then of course there is the accounting for 4 different companies, which is, that's the downside of setting up these things. Yeah. I do have an accountant, but they still send you stuff to look over and check before they send it to HMRC. So that is one of the downsides is, the admin side of that.
I hadn't actually thought about that. It's good to be also very realistic about your expectations when you're going into these projects. There's going to be some more paperwork that you have to get through.
Yeah.
So in terms of collaboration, where do you involve others in these projects? How much of it do you do yourself? Where have collaborations actually been fruitful to drive a project forward or actually inspire you to do more?
So collaboration for me is a more recent thing. For about 10 years, I was doing everything myself. And I would always say, oh, I wish I had somebody to help me do this. I don't have enough money to pay someone. But these are kind of boxes of my own making, right? Is that later on I figured out that firstly, with, say, the Logo Archive zines, is that if you say, we'll work on this together and we'll split profits, and what's really nice is that initially people would say to me, I want to do a zine for free. You know, you don't need to pay me, but I've always been like a 50-50 kind of person. I just think that's fair. And also there's a bit of skin in the game as well if you're splitting production costs. That was my first experience with collaboration. Blair Thompson of Canada Modern was the first collaborative zines extra issue. And so the thing that I learned with the collaborations is that each person is wildly different. Some people like to design really, really quickly, like Jim Sutherland. I went around to his office and we worked one day on the zine trying to figure this thing out, and it was super intense. And then when I was working with Hugh Miller on the Akagari zine, that took us 6 months. And actually, because it was a lot of Japanese logos have a focus on natural phenomena in the work, it felt like we were also enjoying the passing of seasons as we were working on it, because it sort of took such a long time. And Hugh has such a focus, and his work is so nuanced that he needs that time and space to process it. And so I learned so much about that, what it takes to do something like that. So every person I engage with after working with, you know, Blair, Jim and Hugh, is like, you just cannot expect people to behave and see things in the same way. And that's the point of it. And that's the joy of it. And you learn so much from these people. So when it came to building the Logo Archive tool, I just took the same thing. I didn't have a software engineer or a web developer. I couldn't afford one. What could I do? I just gave them half the business and just made it worthwhile. And it was the same with Brand Archive, split the business. And it was the same with BPNO. I split the business between two other people and just made sure that everybody had skin in the game, right? And an interest in making sure that it works. It does make it a little bit complicated on the admin side, but another thing to learn.
I was going to say on the tax side, or at least like the bookkeeping side as well, or?
Yeah, so if you want to allocate shares or a different share model, share classes, I learned that. If you want to redistribute shares, that's an expensive thing to do. The accountants have to do it. There's a lot of paperwork, so I was sending paperwork abroad. Having foreign shareholder, Christian, who works with me on Logo Archive is Austrian. His accountant didn't know what to do with dividends. I didn't know what to do with his dividends, so I just sent them anyway. But for me, it's just, I never thought I would be here talking about this kind of thing. I think it's really nice that we have a design conversation that has this in it. But when I get something really hard through from the accountants and they're hard decisions and I don't understand it, my first instinct is, wow, what a problem to have, right? I'm just kind of grateful to have this kind of problem.
I love that your positive outlook on these projects, and also that you just sort of like try them and then make the most out of them and really plan for longevity. I mean, I was going to end on like, you know, what would be your advice for somebody, you know, just starting out? But I think you've already given so much advice that maybe I'll reframe my last question more as, are you happy with where you're at right now? Or is there still like another thing in the back of your mind of like, I could also try this next project? Are you quite happy with what your setup at the moment?
I'm reticent to sort of talk about happiness, right? It is such an ambiguous term, and it sort of, you define it as you want to define it. I'm pleased and proud of what I've achieved so far.
You should be.
But I always believe that I can do and give more. And with that comes a perpetual frustration and impatience. But that is the thing that keeps driving me forward. So why I get up tomorrow at sort of 6 a.m. So it's just balancing that. Take a moment. Think about what you've achieved and compare it to where you were a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And for me, it's so significantly different that it really helps me think, yes, you've improved, but think about where you're going to be in a year's time and keep going.
Richard, I mean, it's so fun talking to you and hearing the sort of like the backstory behind these projects that have been, you know, dear to my heart over the last 15 plus years. And I think if I can learn anything, it's just to take a more positive approach to these projects, and also just to kind of look at the long goal, like how do I get to where I want to be step by step, and just take that first step. I think that's it's definitely going to help me a lot along the way. I mean, for anybody listening to this, hearing about your work for the first time, make sure you go and check out BP&O, Logo Archive, the Brand Archive. All of these will be linked in the show notes, as well as on madebyfolk.com. And, you know, make sure to follow either of these channels, or no, follow all of them, at least on Instagram, because I think that's where they, you know, it's the best free archive. But, you know, if you are interested in this and find this useful, you know, do support Richard in his projects, because I think you're one of the few people who really strive for a really incredibly high level of quality as well. And you spend a lot of time on the writing. I mean, I would never be able to go into that depth of research and thought and really be so eloquent in describing my thoughts when it comes to just like reviewing a brand project that just came out. So, I mean, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I've taken way too long to have you on my list of guests. I should have done that a long time ago. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Glenn. It's been a pleasure.
That's all for now, folks. Thanks very much for sticking around to the end. Remember to subscribe to the Made by Folk podcast if you're watching this. And if you're listening, go and check out the YouTube channel, because there you can see a lot more of the work that we're talking about today. I'll be back soon with more inspiring conversations with the people behind design. I'll see you then.